Well, hello once again, and our special guest today is on the phone. We are social distancing, and Fred Malone, no stranger to this show, is... Fred, you there?
I'm there. Good afternoon.
You're good.
Hey, are you hearing me all right?
I'm hearing you just fine. I can hear you now.
Good. I'm using my cell phone. We're expecting a call on the home phone, so...
Okay.
I wasn't sure whether this was a good connection or not. I can hear you, but you're not real loud, so...
Okay, I should be louder now. I'm talking directly into the microphone.
So. Hey, yes, there you go. That sounds much better.
There we go.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, how have you been?
I've been doing just fine. How have you and Terry been doing?
Well, we're trying to, social distance and stay at home as much as possible. I'm going to be turning 70 here in a few months, so I'm abiding by all of those... rules, you know, that they say for people over the age of 65, and there's a home phone ringing. My wife will get that in just a minute, hopefully.
Okay.
But other than that, we're both doing very well. Can't complain too much. Eating three meals at home a day, which is putting a little money away, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of helps out.
Saves on money, doesn't it?
It really does.
Well, I understand back in the early part of the century, early part of the last century, we had something similar to this going on.
Well, we did, and I kind of want to talk about that a little bit, and I'm sure I'll have some additional time left over, and when I get to that point, how much time I have, I want to kind of talk a little bit about the history of Marion County and how it got started, because we are, you know, getting ready to celebrate the big bicentennial here coming up, things have been happening, but our... kind of being suspended right now, but they're going to take place again once things get opened up again. But I want to talk a little bit about the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic that swept the world, really, starting in 1918. Actually, I was thinking about this the other day because my grandfather, Jeff McKinley, was born in 1888, so he was 30 years old when the Spanish flu pandemic hit the world, and... survived through it. So I thought this was a good time to talk a little bit about it. You know, people out there are very disturbed about what's going on in the world, as am I, rightfully so. It is scary. And of course, the number of deaths worldwide is going up every day. But when you put it in perspective to what happened in 1918, this is serious, but it's not quite as deadly and as serious as the Spanish flu pandemic was. Of course, every year the H1N1 flu viruses continue to make people sick. You know, all of our medical personnel and our doctors and everyone tell us to get a flu shot every year, which I've done for at least the last 25 or 30 years, I believe. But, you know, even the garden variety flu can be deadly, and a lot of people lose their lives to just ordinary flu every year. But usually... the normal type flus that we see are usually only affect the very young and the very old. But in 1918, however, that same type of flu, mutated into something much more virulent. This new, deadlier flu that they were experiencing acted very strangely. It seemed to target the young and healthy, being particularly deadly to those 20 to 35 years old, unlike today, we're seeing it more actively affecting people over the age of 65. In three waves, from March of 1918 to the spring of 1919, this deadly flu pandemic spread very quickly around the world, actually at that time infecting one-third of the global population of the world and killing at least 50 million people while it was in full speed, which was about 18 to 24 months. Vaccines, just like today, had not been developed yet for this particular flu. So the only methods for fighting the pandemic were, and this is going to really sound familiar to everyone listening, quarantine, mm-hmm. Good hygiene practices, disinfecting everything, and, of course, a limitation to public gatherings or public meetings. You know, and today, the governor said we're still under a 10-day mandate as far as gatherings, even though things are going to start opening up gradually over the next 30 days. But this flu went by very many names, including the Spanish flu. It was called the grip. It was referred to as the Spanish lady. The three-day fever. Purulent bronchitis, excuse me, sandfly fever, and another one called Blitz Catarrh, and I'm not quite sure where that came from. I'm assuming it came from possibly the Middle East.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It sounded German to me.
I'm sorry?
It sounded German to me.
Yeah, it did. It did kind of sound a little German, especially the Blitz part of it. I'm kind of going through my notes here, so bear with me. No one is quite sure where the Spanish flu first struck. Now, some researchers over the years have pointed out to origins in China. Sound familiar?
Oh, yes.
While others have traced it back to a small town in Kansas. Now, that's a little bit of a stretch between Kansas and China, but that's what the statistics say. The best recorded first case occurred at Fort Riley, which was a military outpost in Kansas, where new recruits were trained before they were being sent to Europe to fight in World War One. Remember World War One?
Mm-hmm.
That had started a few years prior to that, and we were right in the middle of it in 1918. On March the 11th of 1918, a private by the name of Albert Gitchell, who was a company cook, came down with some symptoms that at first appeared to be just a bad cold. So he went to the infirmary. He was isolated. But within an hour, several additional soldiers had come down with the same symptoms and also had to be isolated. Kind of sounds like what occurred in Wuhan, China.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Despite the attempt to isolate with the symptoms, it became very contagious and quickly spread throughout the fort. Very quickly, more than 100 soldiers became ill, and within just a matter of a few days to a week, the number of flu cases had quintupled. So, you know, we're going to get the same thing here. Every so many days, it doubles and doubles again and doubles again. So, soon reports of the same flu were noted in other military camps around the United States. And not too long after that, the flu had infected soldiers on board transport ships. Remember, I said they were on their way to Europe to participate in World War One to fight against the Germans. So unintentionally, not really one part of the plan, the American troops brought the new flu with them to Europe.
Oh.
Now again, we're not sure whether somebody from China imported it to Kansas or it actually started in Kansas. They really don't know that, never have determined that. But beginning in about the middle of May, interesting, we're coming up on May.
Mm-hmm.
The flu started to strike French soldiers as well. Of course, we were allies of the French at the time. So it traveled across Europe very quickly, infecting people in nearly every country, just like what this has done. You know, it starts in China and just kind of spreads throughout the Middle East and then into Europe and then, of course, across the ocean. When the flu rampaged through Spain, the Spanish government publicly announced the epidemic to their people. And since Spain was the first country struck by the flu that was not involved in the war, it was the first country not to censor their health reports. So since most of the people first heard about the flu coming from Spain, it was named the Spanish flu. That's how I got the name Spanish flu, even though it didn't start there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just like what they're talking about now, or at least some of the health predictors are, people from the WHO and the CDC and some of the other health agencies that have been involved in this particular pandemic, they're claiming that the second wave could be more deadly. Well, that's exactly what happened with the Spanish flu. In the latter part of the summer, around August, September of 1918, the second wave of the Spanish flu struck three port cities at nearly the same time. Boston in the U.S., Brest, France, and Freetown, Sierra Leone. And they all felt the problem with this flu and the new mutation immediately. So while the first wave of the Spanish flu was extremely contagious, the second wave was not only contagious, but turned deadly, exceedingly deadly. Just like today, hospitals quickly became overwhelmed by the sheer number of patients, people that were involved or had come down with the flu. And when the hospitals filled up, this is going to sound familiar, tent hospitals were erected on hospital lawns. Buildings were commandeered that were empty and hospital beds were set up in those, just like today. But even worse, nurses and doctors were already in short supply because so many of them of course, had gone to Europe to help with the war effort.
Sure.
So, you know, unlike what we have today, where they're just plain overworked, they were overworked then, but then also they were short because of the war effort. So desperately needing help, hospitals started to actually ask for volunteers from the general public. And we're kind of seeing that a little bit, you know, in this country where hospital workers, doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals from areas in the country that haven't been as hard hit have been going to New York and Philadelphia and California and places to help out as volunteers. So we're seeing that here. Even knowing that they were risking their own lives, just like they're doing now by helping these contagious patients, a lot of people, especially women, signed up anyway to do what they could to help. And that was not only people that were regular healthcare professionals, but people that were just everyday folks that wanted to volunteer and wanted to help. So we're seeing that effort even today with what's going on with the current problem that we have. The victims of the 1918 Spanish flu suffered greatly, as some of the victims that are infected with the COVID-19 are today. Within hours of feeling the first symptoms of extreme fatigue, fever, and headaches, patients would start turning blue. Now, I just heard the other day where in some cases they've seen that some of the people that were infected with COVID-19 have started to show signs of blue fingernails. Have you heard that one?
I had not heard that.
Yeah, I just caught that on the news the other night.
Wow.
But in this particular case, the blue tint became so pronounced that it was really difficult to determine what the person's original skin color. So apparently this was a real high color of blue, and it was evidently one of the symptoms that was affecting almost everybody.
Oh, wow.
Some patients, I guess, would cough with such force they actually tore their abdominal muscles, if you can believe that. Foamy blood would come out of their mouths and noses, and even some blood from their ears. Now, I did hear on the news last night where the police chief in Bucyrus had came out and said that he had been afflicted with COVID-19 and was at home recuperating.
I saw that.
Yeah, he'd mentioned something about having a bloody nose. That was the first time I heard anybody mention that. Although today in the paper, I noticed where they've come out with another list of like 6 or 7 additional symptoms. So there are many more symptoms that are coming out the more people that they find that have the disease. Some people back in 1918 even vomited, and others became incontinent, so they, you know, lost track of their bodily functions. The Spanish flu struck so suddenly and so severe that many of its victims died within 24 hours of showing their first symptom. Now, that hasn't seemed to be a part of what this is, but definitely you can tell why this flu was a lot more deadly than what the current pandemic is that we're going through. Not surprisingly, the severity of the flu was alarming, just like it is to people today. People around the world worried about contracting it. Some cities ordered everyone to wear masks, just like we're going through today.
That sounds familiar.
Yes, it does. Spitting and coughing in public was prohibited. You know, that would be kind of tough if you were coughing severely and not cough in public.
Right, right.
But I guess it was prohibited. Schools and theaters were closed. And along with a lot of other businesses. So, hey, you know, what they're doing today to combat this thing isn't any different than what they did 102 years ago.
Oh, my, yes.
People also tried their own homemade prevention remedies, such as, and please don't anybody do any of this, but this is what they did in 1918. They ate raw onions.
Mm-hmm.
They kept a potato in their pocket. I'm not quite sure what that was supposed to do,
okay,
but that was something that they did. They tried. They were wearing a bag of camphor around their necks, and I'm not sure whether a lot of people of the younger generation know what camphor was, but a lot of treatments that you can buy over the counter today, like the Vicks VapoRub and things like that, have camphorated oil in them.
Yes, they do.
So kind of a... kind of a heavy smelling substance.
I can smell it right now. I can remember what that smells like.
Oh boy,
yes.
Can't you? Yeah, anybody, you know, over the age of probably 45 or 50 will remember that easily. But none of these things stop the onslaught of the flu's deadly second wave. So, you know, even though we're starting to return to some type of normalcy. We need to bear in mind what people like Dr. Fauci and people from the CDC and the World Health Organization are telling us, that this will probably come back again in the fall or winter. Mm-hmm. So don't be surprised if it does. Unfortunately, because of that 50 million body count that was occurred during the 18 to 24 months of the Spanish flu, the number of bodies from the victims of the Spanish flu quickly outnumbered the available resources to deal with them. And we're actually seeing that today, especially in places like New York State, and China, India, places where the outbreak came so fast and killed so many people that, the undertakers, the morgues, they don't have the capacity to take care of them. Morgues were forced to stack bodies like cordwood in corridors. Now, I hope they don't get to that today with this, but with 50 million people dying worldwide, I can certainly see where that would come to pass. And I think, what is the world count now on deaths? Do you remember? I just saw it this morning, and I was trying to jot it down.
Don't have that in front of me at the moment, Fred.
I know it's considerably less than that. I'm thinking somewhere maybe around 100,000 at this point. We're far short of 50 million, believe me.
Yes, we are.
There weren't enough coffins for the bodies, nor were there enough people to actually dig the graves. So in many places, mass graves were dug to free the towns and cities of the masses of the deceased. An interesting side note, I just found this, was that the Spanish flu developed a children's rhyme. You know, of course, kids are always, throughout the ages, kids have made up rhymes to go with just about anything that happened, especially bad things. I remember the Lizzie Borden thing, Lizzie Borden, with the axe and all that, gave her father 50 whacks or whatever it was. But when the Spanish flu killed millions of people around the world, it transcended into the lives of everyone. So, while the adults were walking around wearing masks, children were skipping rope to this particular rhyme. And it went, "I had a little bird, its name was Enza. I open a window and influenza."
Oh. It sounds cute, but it's not really cute. Yeah.
Not really. But I can see kids, jumping rope or skipping down the sidewalk singing, "I had a little bird, its name was Enza. I opened the window and influenza." And again, with the Spanish flu, there was some question as to it being airborne and how long it lived in the air. Now, of course, they're saying today that this doesn't live in the air very long, but I did hear the other day on the news that the COVID-19, the molecules that came from a sneeze or a cough, could actually linger in the air for a number of hours. So if you were on a bicycle path and walking on a bike path and a bike went by you or a person running went by you, even the breathing that they were doing from the exercise could emit these particles in the air, and that could stay active for quite some time. So you could walk right through it, not even knowing it. So wearing that mask would help.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So moving on, the armistice then brings on a third wave of the Spanish flu. On November the 11th of 1918, the armistice, of course, brought an end to World War One. That's when all the boys were coming home.
Right.
People around the world celebrated the end of the war, and they felt very jubilant that perhaps they were free from the death caused by both the war and the flu. However, they were wrong. As people rushed to the streets and gave kisses and hugs to returning soldiers, they also started a third wave of the Spanish flu by that critical contact.
I was reading that the other day, too, yeah.
I'm sorry?
I was reading that the other day, too, on some information, yeah.
Yeah, and not keeping that that 6-foot social distance. So even then, it was important. And, of course, in their jubilation of the boys coming home, they completely forgot about that. Now, the third wave of the flu was not as deadly as the second, but, of course, it was still deadlier than the first. It also went around the world, killing many of its victims, but it received a lot less attention then because people were starting to get their lives over, and they were, done with the war, and most of them were not interested anymore in hearing about or fearing the deadly flu. It was, by that time, still lingering. The third wave of the flu lingered on Some say it ended in the spring of 1919. However, I've read other conflicting reports that say it continued to claim victims clear into the early part of 1920. Eventually, however, the flu did disappear. I don't believe in anything that I've read that they actually ever came up with any kind of a vaccine for it. So I think it basically had to run its course, hence why it took quite so long to dissipate. To this day, no one really knows why it suddenly mutated into such a deadly form. I mean, it was just basically an H1N1 type flu that mutated itself. And they really don't know how to prevent it from happening again. So I guess really kind of what we're seeing is the same thing that happened here. It could have basically been some sort of a laboratory-created flu that mutated, got out of the laboratory, and spread into the general population. Now, that's speculation. And I know that there have been some investigations that have been taking place on behalf of the American government through, I think, some of their clandestine CIA-type operations. You probably heard this rumor, too, that it possibly started in a lab in Wuhan, China, and was accidentally let loose. Again, no proof, and I'm not trying to start that rumor. I'm just picking up on what I've already heard. But really, they never really knew what caused this one to mutate. And believe it or not, they're still continuing to research and learn about the 1918 Spanish flu. So it's gone, but even to this day, Mike, it is not forgotten.
Now, you were asking about numbers a little bit ago while we were talking. I was doing some searching here with my finger. As of now, 3,055,651 coronavirus cases and deaths so far, and I believe this is worldwide, 211,065, which is nothing like, yes.
Well, that's still a far cry short of 50 million.
Yes.
Of course, March, April, May, we're only basically, well, if you want to say March, I've heard some things say that it started in as early as December, or at least there were some memos that floated around in December to that effect. But let's say we're between 3 and 6 months into this, and they're predicting a vaccine won't be available for at least 12 to 18 months from the time that it was supposedly the inception of it in this country, which was, what, February or March.
Mm-hmm.
So we could still be looking at another good year of this. I don't think people need to panic about it. I think what I'm particularly happy with the way the governor of Ohio has handled this. I think he's done an excellent job. I will mention I'm a fifth-generation Democrat, so that's really not easy for me to say. but I've been very impressed with the way he's handled it. I've been very impressed with the way Governor Cuomo has handled the situation in New York with the current pandemic. There have been a few other governors, I think, that have done an excellent job, and I think there's some governors in the southern part of the country that have done a very poor job.
Yes.
And have not served their constituents well. But I did listen to the governor's press conference today. I think I've only missed one, maybe two, since he started doing them. And, of course, we're going to start to open up some of the manufacturing and distribution centers. I guess they're going to start calling back people. Salons or places like that. I need a haircut really bad.
I have scissors.
I'm threatening to do cut my own hair here pretty soon. But I guess we're going to start opening things slowly, and I appreciate the fact that they're doing this in a very timely fashion, because I think if we rush into it, we may find ourselves in the same boat that folks did with the Spanish flu. So anyway, that's a little bit of information on the Spanish flu. It's always kind of fun to find out what you can about things that occurred in history. I was a minor in history in college, and I've always had an interest in history. I don't really consider myself a historian to a great respect, like somebody like David McCullough or Doris Kearns Goodwin, but maybe a minor historian. But I do enjoy looking things up and do enjoy learning more about it. One of these days, I want to come on and talk about the flood of 1913. I think that's another.
Oh yes,
that's a very catastrophe that happened in the Midwest, and particularly in Ohio, that people don't know a whole lot about because it's a generational thing. And again, my grandfather and grandmother, my great-grandparents all lived through that. My mother, of course, wasn't born until after that, but she remembers the 1937 flood, which was even worse than the 1913 flood. They weren't prepared for it. So both of those are kind of interesting. One of these days, we'll talk about that.
Oh, certainly. Now, I like to leave a subject on a good note. The number that have recovered so far from this current pandemic is 919,366.
That's great.
That's a pretty good number.
Yes, it is. It's a very good number. I particularly concerned about myself and try to stay home as much as possible, make the once a week grocery store trip. But because I am an asthmatic, I've had asthma my whole life. My lungs are weaker than most people, so because this is a respiratory-based illness, you know, those people with respiratory problems, like asthma, need to be more cautious than others. So
sure.
If any of your listeners are in the same boat that I'm in, I would strongly urge them to do as much as they can to keep themselves safe and wear that mask. And hey, you know, my wife found some on the Internet. There's some pretty cool ones out there. She's got a couple of Cleveland Indian ones we're going to wear.
There you go. Go Tribe. Or can you say Tribe anymore?
Can't have baseball right now, so I have to wear a baseball mask.
There you go.
Well, by my clock, we've got, roughly 14 minutes or so?
Yeah, about 15 minutes, yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, I thought it might be kind of interesting to point out just a few of the chronologically listed things that occurred in Marion County to kind of lead us up to where we are. And I know I won't get through everything I've got because I got a lot of information. The last time I was on, I think we talked about all the current events and the things that are being planned for the bicentennial. And since all that's on hold, I didn't want to talk about that again. So
sure.
I thought this might be a little bit interesting for people because basically this area pretty much got its start as far back as 1794 because of the Greenville Treaty. Of course, the Greenville Treaty was signed as a result of the War of 1812, and that was on August the 20th of 1794. It was signed in August of during the 1812. I got the exact date for it. August 3rd, 1795.
Okay.
That was when the Greenville Treaty line was established. Now, the east-west part of the line passes 1 mile north of Waldo and Prospect, and most people know that Greenville Treaty line was also Harrison's War Road that ran up through there. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a way you can know that. In 1803, Ohio became the 17th state. Now, Marion County was still unknown at that time, but it was a part of a vast tract of land that was unsurveyed and was supposed to begin to be explored at a later date. Then in 1806, and actually in the spring of 1806, Nathaniel Wyatt, which you should remember that name,
mm-hmm.
and Nathaniel Brundridge, those two families settled near what is present-day Waldo, just below the Greenville Treaty line. Another familiar name, in 1807, William Drake brought his family to what is now Waldo Township, and that was in October of 1807. Of course, Drake is known because of Drake's Folly that occurred during the War of 1812. In 1811, Jacob's Well, which we all know where Jacob's Well is, up at the top of the hill there by the towers,
mm-hmm.
Jacob's Well was found by Jacob Foose, and the blockhouse on the Little Scioto at Rails Corners was probably built this year, although it was built primarily because they were afraid of the Indians, raiding them at that time. In 1812, the War of 1812 began, June 12th, and through present Marion County passed thousands of soldiers from Kentucky and places in Ohio such as Portsmouth, Chillicothe, Delaware, and they were all heading north toward the lake on Harrison's War Road. 1813, Perry's victory on Lake Erie occurred, and that's where he made that famous statement, "We have met the enemy, and they are ours."
Yep.
Moving forward to 1818, squatters were starting to move into this area to better locate good land and participate in the new purchase land sales that were going to take place in 1819. with surveys being done by Thomas Worthington. And that name should sound familiar to everybody. Thomas Worthington, mm-hmm. being, of course, governor of Ohio.
Governor, yes.
And then in 1820, on February the 20th, to be exact, of 1820, Marion County was named and was set off by the legislature as a separate county, along with 13 other new counties. There were no county officials as yet, but settlers found it necessary to ride to Delaware if you wanted to get a marriage license, or you needed the sheriff. Marion County, as a regular geographical unit by itself, dates from this year, but for official business, it was attached to Delaware County. So here's where there's a little discrepancy that comes up as to what year it actually became a county. Some say not till 1822, but technically, by the legislature, it was set out February 20th of 1820. Land sales were held in Delaware for lands in the New Marion County beginning on August the 15th of 1820, that same year. In 1821, Clarendon Village was surveyed and platted. And, of course, on August the 25th of 1821, Marion County's first town became Mr. Baker comes to town.
Ebert
and, of course,
Baker, yes.
We all know who Mr. Baker was, Ebert mm-hmm. Baker. He was a native of Maine and a resident of Newark. But he came here with his family on March the 4th. His purpose was to live here and sell lots for a guy by the name of Alexander Holmes of Newark. And he, of course, has been known as the founder of Marion. He was born on April the 27th of 1780 and then died in October of 1864. On December the 15th of 1823, the legislature ordered the county to hold an election and thus became organized. So that's, I think, sometimes where there's a little discrepancy because the actual filing date for the plat was 1822. That Baker had filed for. May 1st of 1824, Marion County held its first election. We're going to be holding an election actually tomorrow. Hopefully everybody got their ballots in on time.
I did.
I'm assuming you did.
I did. I voted in a different county, but yes, I did.
That's right. You vote in Morrow County, don't
yes,
you?
Yes, I do.
So that's kind of interesting. And then in 1828, the first newspaper available here was the People's Advocate. And actually, I think we have some copies of the People's Advocate in our archives over at the Marion County Historical Society. And I've seen a few of those. Quite interesting. August of 1829, I hit a button on my phone. I wasn't sure what that was.
You're still here.
on August the 3rd of 1829, the Delaware Nation, Indian Nation, gave up its 3 mile square reservation to be moved west. And that became a part of present-day Marion County.
Oh, where exactly? What?
That would be, I'm not sure the exact location, but it would be somewhere in the western part of the county.
Okay.
In 1830, the old stone block was built, the late 20s or 30s. This is the stone building south of the Marion County Bank across the first alley. Immigration direct from Germany began around 1830, and the population of the county doubled from 1830 to 1840 as a result of all the Germans that came. And that's why there's a lot of German names still in and around the Marion area. In 1831, Big Island Village had 3 stores and 2 taverns.
Oh, my.
a lot more than what they got today.
Yep.
The town of Waldo was founded by Milo Pettibone. And, of course, the town was named for his son, Waldo Pettibone. And interestingly enough, the gentleman that plays Benjamin Harrison for us, you know, Tom, mm-hmm. Is going to be portraying Milo Pettibone for their get-together, or as Charlie would like to say, their doings that they're going to hold this summer, provided we're all let out again.
Right.
But anyway, this was on land once owned by the father of President Rutherford B. Hayes, which I didn't know until Tom was doing some research on Benjamin Harrison, and we were talking about, and was doing some research, I'm sorry, on Milo Pettibone, and found out about that President Hayes had owned that ground there. So that was kind of an interesting side note. Let's see, moving on. This name will, people will remember this name. In 1832, the first Bowen House Mm-hmm. The oldest existing residence in Marion was built by Judge Ozias Bowen. Of course, everyone knows who Judge Ozias Bowen was.
For the name.
And he built that house to show people what could be done. And it's located on East Center Street. 1833, John Grimm was killed by a falling tree. He lies buried within the bounds of the East-West County Road 154 in Ritzland Township. And also that same year, the old courthouse was completed. And that, of course, is a present, which predecessor to our present structure. And I have a framed picture of the old courthouse that came out of one of the early atlases that was put out here in Marion County. Every year when we hold the annual rummage sale, you always get a lot of things brought in that people want to donate for the rummage sale. Mm-hmm. This one particular year, someone brought in this atlas. It was one of the first atlases. I can't remember the actual year of it, but it was in really poor shape, and we didn't put it out for sale. In fact, Gail said, "You want this atlas? It's got some great pictures in it." And so I took some of the pictures out of it that were still intact and framed a number of them. I framed one of them of the original jail in Marion County, and now it hangs in the new county jail out where Trekkie used to be.
Right, right.
I presented it to the to the sheriff's department. 1838, Bill Mitchell. Remember Bill Mitchell?
Black Bill?
Came to town, yep, Black Bill. He was an escaped slave and always also very popular here. Barber, butcher, played the banjo. A very popular individual. In 1839, the courthouse riot followed because of the trial and release of Black Bill Mitchell. And that same year, the Marion County Bank was founded under the name of the J.S. Reed and Company.
Oh.
And it actually didn't assume the name of the Marion County Bank until 1843. Now, I didn't know this, but in 1840, General William Henry Harrison spoke in Marion, of course, from his fame being in the War of 1812.
Right.
And this is pre-presidential days, because he died a month after being inaugurated.
Yes, he did.
But in 1840, he spoke in Marion standing on a box on the sidewalk just a little bit north of the present-day Fahey Bank.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, he was, of course, elected as president, but then, as I said, he died a month after the inauguration because he gave that, like, three-hour speech in the pouring down rain and contracted pneumonia.
Yep.
This was known as the Tippecanoe and Tyler campaign. Remember that? Tippecanoe
yes.
and Tyler, too?
Well, I wasn't there personally, but I do remember.
Well, you do remember, yes. Just a little bit before your time. Marion Academy opened in rented rooms on Monday, December the 21st of 1840. I don't know the location, but that was the year that it opened. Here I've got the location. It's a little bit further down. The Academy opened again in the fall in the upper floor of the old stone block building on South Main Street, which I'm not sure that that's gone. I think that's gone. 1845, the Centenary Methodist Episcopal Church was finished, and that was on North State Street.
Okay.
In 1846, the Mexican War began, and there were approximately 12 guys that volunteered from Marion County to go fight the Mexicans.
Oh.
And, of course, the Mexican War was perpetrated by President Polk, James Polk, one of the gentlemen that I like to portray.
Yes.
1847, the Marion Village Council adopted an ordinance prohibiting hogs from running at large in the city of Marion.
They were going hog wild for what I
understand. Oh, they must have been.
Now, 3 minutes.
I find this really interesting. In one of our old newsletters from the Mohawk Historical Society a couple of months ago, or a couple of quarters back, I forget when, Ken Moore, who publishes the newsletter for us, had a whole list of strange laws that were still on the books here in Ohio. And there were some pretty wild ones in there, and this is kind of one of those same things, you know. One of the ones I remember was, I think in Sandusky, Ohio, it was illegal to drive around the square and honk your horn. It's just crazy stuff like that. 1848, the True Home, which is on the southwest corner of East Church and South State Streets, right across from the Marion County Historical Society, was built by Dr. H.A. True.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's still there. It's an excellent example of Gothic Revival. Open now as a museum by appointment. And by virtue of the will of Henry True, grandson of both Dr. D.H. True and Judge Ozias Bowen. We're happy to have that in our community. I wish it could be open on more of a permanent basis, maybe someday. On November the 30th of 1848, Ordinance Number 13 established the first fire company in Marion, and also the first board of health in Marion.
Okay.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting, and we have one of the very early fire apparatus over at the museum that sits just outside the Popcorn Museum. I'm sure you've walked by it many times.
I've seen that, yes. Very fascinating.
But it's the old hand pumper that was pulled by horses, or it could be pulled by men. April the 10th of 1848, the first fire engine was purchased by the city of Marion. If I'm looking at my clock right, we've got about 2 minutes.
We got about 1 minute right now. So,
well, I'm going to say 1849 started the big gold rush in California, and a lot of people from Marion went west to seek their fortune.
Okay.
So that's we'll pick up from there the next time, maybe, and talk a little bit more about it. Maybe we'll get up to present day time.
That sounds like a plan, Fred. Now, in 1848, there was something else to happen. Marion lost part of their land.
Oh, that's true.
To form Morrow County.
That's true, yeah. And only a Morrow Countyan would want to bring that up.
Yes, we would.
Hey, Mike, have a great day.
Well, thanks, Fred. Good to hear from you again today. That was Fred Malone, local historian, very able on the local history. And we appreciate you, Fred. You're still on the air, by the way.
I'm still with you.
Yeah, you're still here, so.
I'm going to drop off. Hey, have a great night.
Okay, you too. Thank you, Fred.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM LP, Marion, Ohio.
I'm Charlie Evers, and I'll be on 10 till 12 today. And welcome your phone calls. Today, I'm going to leave it up to all of you to ask questions.